I do want to say I am frustrated that Director Fitzgerald is once again unable to join us here today. Due to conflicts of interest presented by investments, our CDC director still has to recuse herself on some of the important health issues that we face.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was Senator Patty Murray at a hearing 2 weeks ago, unhappy that CDC Director Brenda Fitzgerald had recused herself again because of financial conflicts. As it turned out, Congress never got to hear from CDC Director Fitzgerald on any issue. On Wednesday, she resigned after 7 months in the job, and one day after Politico revealed that Fitzgerald had bought tobacco stocks while running the CDC. On Pulse Check today, I'll talk to three of my colleagues, Jen Habercorn, Sarah Carlin Smith, and Brianna Ailey, who broke that story and what's next for the CDC. Then after the break, I caught up with Rob Lazaro, an executive at the advisory board company and an old friend, to discuss a much-hyped story this week, Amazon, J.P. Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway's announcement that they are moving into healthcare. Just a reminder that if you like Pulse Check, you can help us by helping us grow. Rate the show on your favorite podcast app, share it with a friend, and email me, ddiamond@politico.com, on who you'd like to hear from next. We have an episode posting soon with Sam Quinones, the author of the award-winning book Dreamland on the Opioid Crisis. It's a good excuse to read the book if you haven't yet for our first Pulse Check book club. And with that, let's get back to the Brenda Fitzgerald news, and here's my roundup with my colleagues. I'm very excited to be now joined by three of the four lady journalists who cover HHS and the social safety net and broke the big story that CDC director, now former CDC director Brenda Fitzgerald, had stocks in her portfolio that were causing financial conflicts of interest. So we'll talk about that story, how the team broke it, and what comes next. We've got Jen Habercorn, Sarah Carlin Smith, and Brianna Ailey making her podcast debut in our studio. Rachana Pradhan is overseas, so she can't be with us now, but we will shout her out as she listens in from overseas. So starting with you, Jen, how did Politico get wind of this story in the first place?
So we were just discussing this earlier because it was a kind of a complicated backstory, but essentially the three of us plus Rachana got some tips from sources saying that there were some issues with Brenda Fitzgerald's ethics agreement. It was taking a long time for that to process. You know, she started the job in July, and in October, November, there were still some issues holding up her agreement. That was a long time. So combination of those source documents plus some comments from lawmakers at congressional hearings in which she, you know, essentially should have testified, and in one case was on the schedule and then backed out. We combined that with the three of us and Rachna's reporting, which led to some showing that there was frustration among lawmakers that she couldn't testify because this ethics agreement and recusal process was taking too long, and then she had conflicts with opioid stocks and cancer detection. And then ultimately, Sarah got a document that showed this week that she owned some tobacco stock that she bought it a month after she started the job at the CDC, which, of course, is a huge conflict of interest. Even though she got rid of that stock later, it's a huge no-no in the public health world to own tobacco stock.
So, Sarah, getting that document this week, how did we get that? Was that something that we had to go through special channels to obtain it?
So there's a law called the Stock Act, and that allows you to submit requests to get financial transaction reports of members of Congress and other senior federal government officials. So we were able to submit requests a number of months ago to get just an initial sense of what were all the financial holdings she had in place when she came into HHS and the CDC. And then we followed up a few months later to get a report of all the transactions she had since made while in office, and that enabled us to see the stock holdings. And then we were able to combine that with a FOIA that Brianna had filed to get a list of her schedules and get a sense of, okay, here's her financial holdings, what activities was she working on then that may be related to that. So that was interesting as well.
And the Stock Act also reared its head about a year ago with Tom Price, and that's how some of the financial conflicts in his background were unearthed, though it didn't stop his nomination at the time. Thinking about the mix of both document requests and human sources, Bree, Brenda Fitzgerald had not been very prominent. She had not been someone that we got to really know all that much because she had been excusing herself from public appearances. What were some of the conflicts that Fitzgerald was unable to really get into because of her financial interests?
Well, we know based on her ethics agreement that she couldn't work in cancer detection or elements of the opioid crisis, basically dealing with health IT. We don't know the full aspect of how her what her recusals actually meant. So HHS was kind of unclear with us on what she actually was able to participate in those areas. So we did, like Sarah said, we got a FOIA of her calendar. So we know that she was taking meetings, brief meetings on opioids, cancer. She did a little... she actually did a tour of a tobacco lab like the day after she bought the tobacco stock. So we found that pretty interesting and illuminating.
So she has said through her spokespeople that she didn't know of these purchases when they're happening. She tours the tobacco lab right after the stock purchase.
So that's not quite what they've told us. So HHS has told us that her financial advisor, I think that's not sure that's the correct term, but made the purchases, but they never told us whether she was or wasn't aware of them, whether she did or did not have to sign off on them or approve them. So that's an open question here. And that may be important to some degree to know, you know, how actively she was overseeing her financial portfolio. But she had already started the job at HHS and been there for a few months. And in talking to a number of ethics officials, lawyers who work on this issue, they have said, you know, HHS would normally counsel somebody in that role and while you're going through the divestment process to be very careful, especially before you have a formal ethics agreement in place. The other thing is once she had an ethics agreement, you see it specifically says that it's her responsibility to tell the financial advisor what she can and cannot do. So regardless of whether she was the one actively, you know, making the decisions to buy or sell the stock, a lot of the responsibility, legally, ethically, and otherwise, falls back on her. It's her responsibility to know, I am the CDC director, I have this huge public health responsibility, and it likely will be viewed, at least at best, as a big optics issue for me to be purchasing tobacco stock.
And how was it being viewed, Jen, on the Hill, where she was unable to testify and where these financial questions were starting to swirl?
I think that's where a lot of this, you know, Secretary Azar just started the job on Monday, and today it's Wednesday, and she's resigned. And the issue facing him was his CDC director didn't have the confidence of the Hill anymore. Now, this is not a confirmable position, so the Senate never had to meet one-on-one with lawmakers, and she wasn't able to build that goodwill in Congress. Senate Republicans were getting really frustrated because she had twice pulled out of hearings that she was on the schedule for and then had to get off because she couldn't talk about these things.
And just to underscore that, Senate Republicans, not just Democrats, Republicans were annoyed.
Right. Three Senate Republicans told me in a story that Bree and I reported this month that she had assured them that she was going to get her conflicts resolved. This was before we knew about the tobacco stocks. This was the previous recusals that she had told them she's going to get rid of these. I'm going to be able to testify. And these lawmakers were not willing to, you know, they weren't willing to trash her or anything like that. But made clear that this was an issue and that they wanted her to testify. I mean, opioids is a huge public health crisis. There's a lot of focus in the Senate Help and in Energy and Commerce committees to tackle this year. And you need a public voice out there talking about why it's a problem, why Congress needs to pay for programs for it. And they didn't have that in her. But you're right. Democrats were frustrated too. Patty Murray, the top Democrat on the Help Committee, went even further than Republicans, said she was frustrated that they need a CDC director who can do her job in a full-time capacity. So, yeah, you had that going. It was kind of crescendoing. And then these tobacco stocks appeared to be just the breaking point that she wasn't going to be able to recover from.
There's another factor here, too, which is she had been Georgia Health Commissioner. She was an ally of Tom Price. No more Tom Price. New HHS Secretary Azar may or may not feel any obligation to protect Price allies and the team assembled around him. So he now has this opportunity to have a clean slate. Who is currently serving now as head of CDC, Brianna? Is it someone that listeners would know, someone who's been in this space before?
Yeah, so she was actually named today, Anne Chuchat. She was previously the acting director of the CDC when Tom Frieden stepped down last year. And so she's filling that role at this point. And she's also maybe potentially rumored to take over as permanent head of the CDC.
This is a widely respected career official.
Yes.
Who's been there for years and years. If looking at now CDC, HHS, obviously with Price had conflicts of his own, these are not like deep-seated secret conspiracies. These are things like, in Price's case, taking charter jets after he had bashed them. As Sarah was saying, Fitzgerald having stock holdings that really should have been known. What does this say about this administration? Can we take a step further in thinking about how prepared were they to take on these big roles that historically are under a lot of scrutiny?
Some of the people I talked to in this story really felt like this was just one in a bigger picture of the Trump administration being, you know, not taking ethics seriously enough. They've pointed to stories about top White House officials that still in this month in January, over a year after being in the White House, still haven't filed their own financial paperwork that shows that they're not, you know, using their White House position in a way to influence their financial advisors or financial position. Obviously, we know there's just been in general lots of questions about Trump and, you know, whether he's really stepped back from his business, his holdings, how he's using his hotel and his place at Mar-a-Lago and so forth to maybe profit off the presidency. So I think there is this bigger picture of people being concerned that the Trump administration's not that concerned about ethics. And they feel like if he's not leading on the ethics front, why would lower down officials feel like they need to take it seriously? And that's a question people have raised, is maybe they just felt like this was okay because our leadership is sort of telling us it's okay, we don't have to take ethics seriously.
And one thing that I learned in the course of our reporting was that the HHS Ethics Office has one of the most strongest policies across the government. And just, you know, you think about the control they have, they can really drive stock prices up and down with big major decisions on vaccines and drug approvals and things like that. And the HHS Ethics Office is run by career folks who've been there, who know, you know, what to look out for and things like that. And when you get one of these jobs, particularly a CDC director, you are given a really intense briefing and you're advised, particularly before the ethics agreement is signed, like Sarah mentioned, that really it's a horrible idea to buy any stock because you are so vulnerable to criminal liability. And in a criminal case, they would just have to prove, one, that you have a financial interest, which, of course, owning a stock would be, and two, that you had a significant role in a decision that affected that stock. And you think about the decisions these folks are in, the meetings they're in. You know, on one hand, you could say it's easy to prove that they had a role in a decision. On the other hand, it's hard to prove if you're just in a meeting that you had a big role in that kind of decision. But it seems like a huge, huge risk to take to just have one part of that two-part criminal puzzle by having a financial stake. So, you know, it's a question of, you know, was she adequately briefed on the risk here, or was it something where, you know, she didn't take it seriously or communication wires got lost?
Yeah, I talked to a number of people who said in the past, the way HHS Ethics Office would work is if you're having anybody at that high level like Fitzgerald, they would work with you before you actually stepped into the job as a matter of practice to try and get as much done as possible before you get in the door so you don't leave yourself vulnerable to risk. In Fitzgerald's case, she got a number of exemptions and delays in terms of when she had to submit what she owned financially to HHS. She completed her ethics agreement in a time period which people say is much too slow. And I think there's maybe this feeling of, okay, well, I got these exemptions and I didn't have the ethics agreements in place yet. Maybe I'm okay. But the ethics agreement is really there to just sort of help guide her and protect her so she clearly knows this is what I can do, this is what I can't do. But it doesn't protect you in the sense of, if something isn't on the ethics agreement, but it is ethically volatile, that doesn't actually help her. So people were saying, okay, say she has this ethics agreement and for some reason she didn't or forgot to, or even just accidentally didn't disclose, you know, a tobacco stock holding and then did something related to tobacco. Just because it wasn't in the ethics agreement doesn't protect her. So I think that's kind of important, too, as well, because you sort of think about these ethics provisions as being there to lay the guidelines. And actually, it's really more to protect somebody. And so your responsibilities just kind of go a different way.
We've hit on this in a few different ways, but to really spotlight it, Alex Azar has been HHS secretary formally for about 48 hours at the time of us recording this podcast. And he's already made a couple big decisions, including this one. I mean, this is already at the top of the list. What does this tell us about Azar, if anything?
I think we can say, he presented himself in his confirmation hearings as no nonsense, no drama. He wanted to put Price's ethical problems behind him. And this, you know, could be seen as a sign that he wants to do that, that he wants to run a shop that's very no drama. I was told that internally at CDC, before Azar came in, that there was speculation that if she didn't get these previous recusals cleared up by the time he got in, that it was going to be a problem. And as we indicated earlier, you know, the tobacco holdings might have been the straw that broke the camel's back.
One closing thought here, and it's always struck me as someone who covers the space, that CDC has been a little bit of a tougher nut to crack. It's miles away. It's not physically present in D.C. like HHS. I'm not as well sourced there. So some of the things with Brenda Fitzgerald, at least in my world, have been a little bit out of sight, out of mind, partly because she hasn't been talking and partly because it's in Atlanta. As we think about what this episode reveals, what does it say about CDC and its place in the HHS firmament?
Well, I think it's the Hill reputation is at stake because, a lot of Washington is out of sight, out of mind. CDC is one of the few federal agencies that isn't based in Washington, so they're not constantly on Capitol Hill. I mean, the other agencies have better reputations with Republicans. So that matters a lot when you're talking about huge amounts of money.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen in past years, CDC often hasn't done that great with the Republican appropriations. So not having Brenda Fitzgerald being testifying in front of them in Congress multiple times on appropriations issues, I think really hurts them a lot. They get a lot of money from the CDC Prevention Fund, which was part of Obamacare, which Republicans
12% have repeatedly, of the budget.
Yeah, repeatedly tried to cut and have to some degree cut a decent amount over the years. So again, not having, when you're already an agency that doesn't have, it's not the NIH, Republicans aren't trying to throw money at it, they're trying to give the money, CDC's money, to NIH and take away from CDC, to not have somebody here who Republicans really like and see as an ally was, I think, a bit problematic over the past few months.
Well, and it was an especially important year, I think, for CDC to have a presence because the president's budget proposed an 18% budget cut to the CDC, and we're expecting something that potentially could be similar this year. So having that presence on the Hill is important.
We'll leave it there. Brianna Ailey, Sarah Carlin Smith, Jen Habercorn, and a shout out to Rachana Pradhan, who decided to skip the podcast and stay in her international travel. The amazing lady reporters who broke this story. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Amazon, JP Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway on Tuesday announced that they've teamed up to improve healthcare for their employees. And they'll pursue that objective through, and I quote, an independent company that is free from profit-making incentives and constraints. When I heard about this news, I immediately thought of my friends at the advisory board company, my old employer, who spend quite a bit of time tracking healthcare transformation and the companies that are eyeing the market. And I sat down with Rob Lazaro to go deeper into this story. I'm joined now, and it's a real treat, by Rob Lazaro, Managing Director at the Advisory Board Company.
Thanks for having me, Dan. I'm having flashbacks to our previous life of podcasting together years ago.
It's true. We did a podcast at the Advisory Board. It has mostly been lost to time and the vagaries of the internet. And I should probably say up front, there are a zillion different conflicts in this conversation. I still have ties to the Advisory Board Company, personal ties. The advisory board was purchased not so long ago by Optum, which is owned by United Healthcare. So as listeners are processing the conversation, just know that's not something we're really going to get into. And Rob, I will say up front, this story about Amazon, JP Morgan, Berkshire Hathaway, it broke on Tuesday. I mostly ignored it. I was tied up with political stories that we were covering in healthcare. And I feel like we have been here before with these big disruptive announcements. Convince me, why does this matter?
It's a great question, Dan. And honestly, I don't know if I'm going to convince you or the folks who are listening why this matters, but I can at least give you some color into why we've been talking about it for the past 36 hours and why I'm excited to be here talking with you about it today. We've been waiting for a while, and kind of the healthcare industry writ large has been waiting for a while to see what Amazon is going to do in healthcare. It's a question that I get all the time from hospital and health system leaders. And I think the assumption was that it was going to be something consumer facing. They've built this incredible retail platform. You know, was it going to be something around pharmaceutical distribution? Was it going to be something else selling directly to consumers? And I think it was a bit of a surprise to see Amazon, yes, is getting into healthcare through a partnership route, but not in a consumer-oriented strategy right now, but something that is very internal and thinking about their own healthcare costs. So I think the fact that Amazon's here is looking at healthcare was the big eye-catching headline. I think it's playing out in a way that is quite different than we all might have expected.
Well, let's first revisit something you just said. Amazon, along with Walmart, those two have been kind of the big bogeymen that if either company decided to go after healthcare in a meaningful way, it could shake up.
Well, and for the same reason. They both have incredibly close relationships with consumers. The fact that there could be one day a convenient care clinic in Walmart's and cities across the country, that could be a very different entrance point to the healthcare industry.
And Mikaela, our podcast producer, made the point that Amazon, she wishes, took over more parts of the American economy, just because there's so much familiarity with shopping through Amazon, using Amazon.
Well, I'll be the first to admit, I buy tons of stuff through Amazon. I watch their streaming content. I store my photos there. It's a part of my everyday life. Not in healthcare right now, but you could see them want to go in that direction. But that's not where they are right now. Again, they're thinking about their employees and their spending on healthcare.
So with Berkshire Hathaway and JP Morgan, the three of these juggernauts combined have a million employees, and that's where they're focusing their, whatever this is going to be, this very vague announcement that landed Tuesday.
Well, that's right. And the irony is we actually know very little. So there's a lot of commentary.
But that hasn't stopped all the headlines.
No, and it's not going to stop us today talking about it. But we know very
well. Part of us talking about it is I want to know what I need to know. And right now, I'm not sure I need to know that much.
Well, I think at this point, we're largely speculating about what they could be doing. But if we think about the scale of the project right now, so it is some sort of new entity jointly through Amazon, JP Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway. And if you add up their employee base, it's about 1.2 million people. That's actually smaller than some of the other employer coalitions we've seen. So there's the Health Transformation Alliance. That has about 4 million covered lives. So somewhat smaller, but I think it is an interesting collection of companies that are coming together. You know, I will admit I did not wake up yesterday morning, the day of the State of the Union, expecting to see those three names together.
That's true. I mean, just Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, Jamie Dimon, these are titans of industry. And apparently some of this came out of just their conversations that the three of them and their companies could make a difference when so many others have failed to move the ball in healthcare.
Well, I've got to hand it to Warren Buffett for having the quote that's grabbed the headlines. I'll admit that I first heard about this first thing yesterday morning talking to a healthcare executive who mentioned, have you read the Tapeworm article yet?
So yeah, the quote from Buffett was, the ballooning costs of healthcare act as a hungry tapeworm on the American economy. And this, Rob, it's a great line, but this is a sentiment that leaders of Google, of Microsoft, other healthcare innovators, for as long as I have been doing this, which is over a decade, and well before, just reading back to like Jim Clark, the founder of Netscape in the 1990s, I swear you and I did a podcast on this at the advisory board 3 years ago. We were talking about all the Silicon Valley promises that they've been unable to deliver. For all the talk of innovation and disruption, these companies never really seem to move the dial.
Well, and I think the challenge of the effort came through, and the enormity of the effort, frankly, comes through in the announcement. When I read through it, some of the things that jumped out at me was how they kept reiterating through all the different statements that this is a long-term effort, that it's going to be challenging, that it's worth the effort, but it needs a beginner's mind and a lot of patience. So I think they recognize that it's kind of uphill sledding. I don't think that undercuts the fact that they feel incredible urgency. So employers across the country, they're seeing their healthcare costs go up 6-7% a year, and they're finding that a lot of the strategies they've used in the past about going self-funded, about increasing consumers' deductibles or their employees' deductibles, aren't generating the returns that they'd want to see to be able to at least plateau or rein in their healthcare spending, at least the growth of it.
Well, one issue on that is, hasn't healthcare spending overall slowed down in the past number of years? There had been this very steep curve in costs going up, sometimes double digits year over year. Since the ACA passed, the healthcare cost curve has been slower. So is there as much opportunity for a disruptive group to come in because some of those lower hanging efforts have already been snatched?
Well, I would argue the fact that they did make this announcement and are going this direction shows that they think there is ample opportunity left. I don't think these three pretty sophisticated companies that could be doing plenty of things together separately would choose to focus on healthcare if they didn't think there was a real opportunity there and weren't continuing to feel the squeeze in their business.
Fair point that there are a lot of dollars out there in healthcare that different companies are moving to capture. I did think Zach Cooper, the Yale professor who has been on this podcast before, had a really good line here. He said, I do hope Amazon, JP Morgan, and Berkshire succeed. However, it's a bit like Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, and Partners Health coming out and saying they don't like their computers, so they're going to form a new IT company. These are not companies that have decades of experience in healthcare, which, unlike selling shoes online like Amazon does, healthcare is regulated in a zillion different ways. There are existing referral patterns. There are behavioral things about choosing a doctor that are very different than choosing where I'm going to buy a DVD.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that is, I think those are a lot of the structural barriers that previous innovators and companies have run into, and that has slowed down success and effort so far. I mean, I remember we've had conversation in the past about the potential to sell health insurance across state lines. And why is that a bit of a myth? Well, because health insurers don't have a network across that state line. So if these companies, and again, we're getting into the realm of speculating about what they might do, if they want to act more like a health insurer, is that a capability they have? So one thing that jumped out to me in the announcement was they reiterated that these companies have complementary skill sets and assets. So Amazon, of course, has a lot of technology experience and has built a pretty powerful technology platform, and AWS is a giant tech platform.
AWS, Amazon Web Services.
JP Morgan has a ton of intellectual capital and financial capital, and they run one of the preeminent healthcare conferences of the year. You were just out there. So they clearly have experience in the healthcare sector. And then Berkshire Hathaway, I had to think a little bit. One of my colleagues very astutely pointed out they own GEICO. So they have insurance experience. Unclear if auto insurance translates exactly to health insurance or if that's the angle that they would want to go in, but there are some seeds of experience there.
They could pull from across their portfolio. And Amazon specifically had been hiring up on the healthcare side. Chrissy Farr from CNBC had reported a few weeks ago they had brought in this top doctor who specialized in primary care. I guess, Rob, if we're looking at healthcare 2018 versus healthcare 2010 or 2008, let's just decade over decade.
So before the Affordable Care Act.
Before the ACA took effect. How different is the U.S. healthcare system now than it was before the sweeping reforms of the ACA, which did more than just expand coverage? They created different incentives for creation of accountable care organizations and other trickle-down effects that shifted the direction of healthcare.
Well, I think there's some things that are pretty fundamentally different. And healthcare is a enormous industry. It is slow moving. I was talking with an executive yesterday who said, it's been a long time since I've come to one of these conferences, and it's amazing kind of the incremental progress of the healthcare industry, and that we're still talking about some of the same issues. There are three things that I would point out that to me feel different 2018 compared to 2008. First, there's been a big push for delivery system reform and transformation. So you mentioned accountable care organizations or ACOs, there are bundled payments. There are all these new models for how providers can get paid that are designed to motivate different behavior. And sometimes it's about providing a more coordinated episode of care, maybe doing so at a lower price point for that episode. That's essentially what a bundle payment is in a nutshell. Maybe it's an incentive designed to reduce the total amount of care, like in an accountable care organization. So first, there's been change in or at least new models for how providers can get paid. Slow and steady growth there, but we are seeing movement. Second, we are seeing consumers facing larger and larger share of the healthcare bill. So I mentioned earlier that deductibles continue to go up. I remember one of my first jobs in healthcare was an internship with the health insurance commissioner in a state. And my first project was calling health plans, secret shopping around high deductibles and asking a set of questions. We're talking about $1,000 health plan, $1,000 deductibles at that point. Very different than the $5,000 to $10,000 family deductibles that we see right now. So the end user of healthcare has a lot more financial exposure and financial as well as literal skin in the game. And then finally, patients have a lot more choice in how they access care. We weren't talking about virtual visits 10 years ago, right? We weren't talking about going to a convenient care site and whether it's at a workplace or at a pharmacy. We were talking about going to your doctor's office or going to the hospital. So we have new payment incentives, we have more financial accountability for our patients, and we have new options. So I think in many respects, the experience of receiving and the finance of care has changed a lot in 10 years.
You can't talk about Optum and United, but I can say something quickly, which is United has made a series of acquisitions. It's gotten bigger. It's gotten into different places in healthcare. We've seen CVS and Aetna looking at a deal where Aetna, an insurance company, CVS, pharmacy benefit manager, would combine. There are these new and unusual alignments emerging across healthcare. Are there any other shoes to drop, Rob, in terms of big companies beyond Amazon, beyond Walmart, or is this kind of the end of these alignments for now?
Well, now we're really speculating, Dan. I think first of all, there's been a ton of deal making in the past few months. So December was busy. Whole fourth quarter of last year was busy. 2018 has been off to a busy start on the deal-making front. A lot of the initial deals that you described and some of the big transactions involving large national health plans have been about combining different assets of provider and payer capabilities. The latest news of partnership before we got to Amazon, of course, was about a bunch of prominent progressive health systems coming together to potentially become manufacturers or distributors of generic pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, that announcement went a little bit under the radar, but the idea that they were going to do their own drug company, essentially.
Exactly. So it's a very different element of, and I'm going to use kind of air quotes here, vertical integration. If the deals we were talking about at the end of last year were about payer-provider relationships, the pharmaceutical one is about provider-supplier. So we're trying to figure out kind of collectively what is the right set of assets that you need to have together to create a sustainable healthcare company, given a lot of the broader trends around new payment models, about downward pressure on reimbursement rates, about accelerating input costs, trying to figure out how you can create a company that is sustainable and then can also deliver sustainable product for the end users. And I think that's, frankly, where Amazon and JP Morgan and Berkshire Hathaway are coming in. They're trying to figure out how do they make healthcare affordable for them.
So for all this talk about deal making and the skepticism that I and I'm sure others have about what could happen, can we spend maybe the last few minutes just talking about what would this look like? What could they conceivably do with their resources and the mission that they've articulated?
So at this point, it's a lot of speculation. It's really what could they be doing? One of the things that jumped out to me in the announcement and all the coverage is the focus on their interest in technology solutions. So we talked earlier about how Amazon has a lot of experience here. So I've been thinking about, well, what kind of technology solutions could they be providing to their employees? And I often think about that, and I've been thinking about this through the lens of what are we seeing other innovators or other companies doing to use technology to try to rein in their healthcare spending. A lot of it has been around transparency. So trying to give employees, give patients more data, more information on where they should be or could be receiving their care, both in terms of quality and the price of it. That's one angle. You could see them using technology to actually change the care experience. So are we looking at 1.2 million employees and their family members who are receiving virtual visits as the front door of the delivery system? Right. That's very different than CVS and Aetna coming together to create a new physical front door of the delivery system, as they said. So it'll be interesting to see how they harness technology, how they harness data, both to I would assume, try to redirect business, redirect where care is being provided, as well as potentially make it a much more virtual, maybe even automated experience one day. But that's all speculation, so I guess we're going to be in this together seeing what happens.
Well, I appreciated you coming and running through the speculation and trying to push back against my cynical take as usual. It's good to see you, buddy.
Likewise. Hope you're holding back.
Rob Lazaro from the Advisory Board Company, old friend, talking about a new deal. Thanks, Rob. That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to my colleagues, Jen Habercorn, Sarah Carlin-Smith, Brianna Ailey, and Rachana Pradhan, who did all the work on the Brenda Fitzgerald Newsbreak. My thanks to Micaela Rodriguez for producing the podcast and Rob Lazaro for trekking over to Roslyn to record an interview with me. If you like Pulse Check, please rate us, review us, send me an email at ddiamond@politico.com, and read Dreamland, Sam Quinones' book on the opioid crisis, so you'll be ready for that upcoming episode where we go deeper with him. And you'll find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week.